Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Confederate and Neo-Confederate Reader, The Great Truth About the Lost Cause, edited by James W. Lowen and Edward H. Sebesta, narrated by Paul Bamer. Introduction. Unknown, well-known documents. James W. Lowen. Anyone who knows the history of the Civil War and its aftermath, and who talks with members of the public, quickly grows frustrated. Most recent high school graduates, many history and social studies teachers, and even some professional historians whose training is in other areas, hold basic misconceptions about the era. Questions about why the South seceded, what the Confederacy was about, and the nature and later use of its symbols and ideology often give rise to flatly untrue answers. In turn, these errors persist because most Americans do not know or have never read key documents in American history about the Confederacy. The documents included here also make a case for teaching every American the word and the concept, historiography. Most concisely, historiography means the study of history, but not just studying history. Historiography asks us to scrutinize how a given piece of history came to be written, who wrote it, when, with whom were they in debate, what were they trying to prove, who didn't write it, what points of view were omitted, especially on the subjects of slavery, secession, and race, the core of this volume. Confederate and neo-Confederate statements change depending upon where people wrote or spoke, and when, and why. Why did Confederates say they seceded for slavery in 1861, but not in 1891? Why did neo-Confederates claim in 1999, but not in 1869, that thousands of African Americans served in the Confederate Armed Forces? Teachers can use questions like these to get students to understand and do historiography on the documents in this collection. By no means is this the only selection of Confederate and neo-Confederate writings and speeches that could be made. Jefferson Davis's Rise and Fall of the Confederate Government runs two volumes and more than 1,500 pages by itself. The Confederate and neo-Confederate literature is vast. Any book-length selection is bound to be arbitrary, at least to some degree. But not all writing by Confederate or neo-Confederate leaders is part of that literature. Before Virginia seceded, for example, Robert E. Lee wrote eloquently against such a move. We do not include his piece because his was not a Confederate position. During Reconstruction, his corps commander, James Longstreet, became a Republican and favored equal rights for all. We do not include excerpts from his autobiography because his was not a neo-Confederate position. Of course, not all Confederates or neo-Confederates held identical points of view, and our selections show considerable diversity. Nevertheless, a core of Confederate and neo-Confederate thought evolved over time that we have tried to present here. Why did the South secede? In 1998, I was honored to give the 14th Dortch Lecture at the Greensboro Historical Museum in North Carolina. The auditorium was full and overflowed to another room with closed-circuit TV. This was an audience of people deeply interested in history, including many members of the museum. During my talk, I asked the crowd, "Why did we have a civil war?" All knew that the Civil War resulted from the secession of South Carolina, followed by 10 other states. So the question became, why did South Carolina, followed by 10 other southern states, secede? The group generated four answers: slavery, states' rights, tariffs and taxes, and the election of Lincoln. They agreed that those answers exhausted the likely alternatives. I then asked them to vote. "This is not Chicago," I said. "You may only vote once." States' rights drew half the votes. Slavery received a fourth. Tariffs and taxes and the election of Lincoln split the remaining 25% about evenly. Then I asked, what would be the best evidence to resolve the matter? Individuals volunteered, diaries from the time, and newspaper articles. Not bad answers, but hardly the best. Then one man asked, wasn't there some sort of convention? Didn't it say why South Carolina was leaving the Union? Such a convention did meet, of course, in Charleston. In December 1860, it voted to take South Carolina out of the United States. As it did so, it indeed explained why, in a document titled Declaration of the Immediate Causes Which Induce and Justify the Secession of South Carolina from the Federal Union. The declaration begins with a biased and incomplete history of the formation of the United States. Then it lists South Carolina's grievances against the North. We assert that 14 of the states have deliberately refused, for years past, to fulfill their constitutional obligations, and we refer to their own statutes for the proof. The only constitutional obligation that concerned South Carolina in 1860 was the Fugitive Slave Clause, which the Declaration proceeds to quote. Delegates then note an increasing hostility on the part of the non-slaveholding states to the institution of slavery. The document immediately lists those states and the rights they tried to exercise to avoid being complicit with slavery. The states of Maine, New Hampshire, Vermont, Massachusetts, Connecticut, Rhode Island, New York, Pennsylvania, Illinois, Indiana, Michigan, Wisconsin, and Iowa have enacted laws which either nullify the acts of Congress or render useless any attempt to execute them. In many of these states, the fugitive is discharged from service of labor, claimed, and in none of them has the state government complied with the stipulation made in the Constitution. A few northern states further infuriated South Carolina by letting African Americans vote, even though who could vote was a state matter until the 14th and 15th Amendments to the U.S. Constitution, adopted after the Civil War. South Carolina was also upset that northern states have permitted the open establishment among them of abolitionist societies. To South Carolina fine eaters, northern states did not have the right to let their citizens assemble and speak freely, not if what they say might threaten slavery. In short, South Carolina was not for states' rights, but against them. This was only to be expected, of course, because Southern planters had been in power during the Buchanan administration, indeed, throughout most of our history. In an oft-quoted phrase, James Henry Hammond, senator from South Carolina, noted in 1858 that Southerners had ruled the nation for 60 out of 70 years of her existence. The party in power always opposes states' rights. It's in their interest to do so. Instead, as these excerpts show, the document is suffused with concern about slavery. None of the 50% of my audience who had voted for states' rights meant that South Carolina seceded because it was against states' rights, that it was outraged at states' rights. Yet, that would be more accurate. Many audience members actually sat with their mouths open as I read from the South Carolina document, taking in this information, brand new to them. Lincoln's election triggered secession, of course, and South Carolina says so, but it acted as a trigger precisely owing to his opposition of slavery. Debating Stephen A. Douglas in 1858, for example, even in southern Illinois, Lincoln had referred to the crisis over slavery in these words: "It is the eternal struggle between two principles, right and wrong, throughout the world. It is the same spirit that says, 'You toil and work and earn bread, and I'll eat it,' no matter what in shape it comes, whether from the mouth of a king who seeks to bestride the people of his own nation and live by the fruit of their labor, or from one race of men as an apology for enslaving another race. It is the same tyrannical principle." When South Carolina's declaration denounced the election of a man to the high office of President of the United States, whose opinions and purposes are hostile to slavery, it described Lincoln accurately. Indeed, Lincoln's words were anathema to slave owners, who increasingly defined slavery as right. Hence, the eighth of my audience that had chosen that answer were not wrong, although the election of Lincoln amounts to another way of saying the South seceded for slavery. Unfortunately, only a relative handful in my audience had chosen that alternative. That was North Carolina, I thought to myself afterward. The audience was overwhelmingly white. Most were over 50 years old. Many had taken U.S. history before or during the Civil Rights Movement, when public education in the South was deliberately used as a tool of white supremacy. By chance, my next speaking engagement was at St. Cloud State University, northwest of Minneapolis. On a whim, I asked students the same question I had posed in Greensboro. To my surprise, I got the same responses in almost the same proportions. Miseducation about why we had a civil war was hardly limited to Dixie or to those educated long ago. Lest readers imagine that we are making too much of a single source, we hasten to point out that at least four other states, when seceding from the Union, incorporated passages and ideas from South Carolina's document in their statements telling why. These statements are included in this collection. The Secession Convention in Texas, for example, proclaims the states of Maine, Vermont, New Hampshire, Connecticut, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, New York, Pennsylvania, Ohio, Wisconsin, Michigan, and Iowa, by solemn legislative enactments, have deliberately, directly or indirectly violated the third clause of the second section of the fourth article of the Federal Constitution and laws passed in pursuance thereof. Texas lists about the same states in about the same order, and the constitutional clauses they are charged with violating is, of course, the same fugitive slave clause about which South Carolina complains. Mississippi even copies South Carolina's title in its address setting forth the declaration of the immediate causes which induce and justify the secession of Mississippi. And again, concern over slavery permeates the document. Our position is thoroughly identified with the institution of slavery. A blow at slavery is a blow at commerce and civilization. That blow has been long aimed at the institution and was at the point of reaching its consummation. There was no choice left us but submission to the mandates of abolition or a dissolution of the Union. As well, South Carolina and other Deep South states sent ambassadors to other states that allowed slavery to persuade them to secede. These envoys use similar language, stressing slavery first, last, and foremost. Georgia's Henry Benning, for instance, speaking to Virginia's secession convention, begins by asking, what was the reason that induced Georgia to take the step of secession? Then he continues, the reason may be summed up in one single proposition. It was a conviction, a deep conviction on the part of Georgia, that a separation from the North was the only thing that could prevent the abolition of her slavery. No one doubted in the 1860s that secession was for slavery. When Abraham Lincoln said in his second inaugural, all knew that his interest, slavery, was somehow the cause of the war. He was not trying to convince his audience. He was merely stating the obvious en route to some searing statements about slavery, God, and justice. The documents prove it, including Lincoln's second inaugural, for that matter, if only we would read and teach them. Teachers especially need these documents. That verb, teach, holds a special relevance. In 2008 to 2009, teachers underscored to me the need for this book. I led workshops for teachers of U.S. history and social studies in school systems across the United States, California, Florida, Illinois, Iowa, Louisiana, Maryland, Michigan, Minnesota, North Dakota, Ohio, Oregon, and Tennessee. During the workshops, I asked the teachers the same question I had posed in Greensboro a decade earlier. Why did we have a civil war? Again, all the teachers understood that the civil war resulted from the secession of South Carolina, et al. So, again, the question became, why did South Carolina, followed by 10 other southern states, secede? Quickly, the teachers supplied the same four answers that had come from my Greensboro and St. Cloud audiences. Again, I asked them to vote, but with one twist. You have to vote once. No abstentions, okay? They agreed. When the polls closed, teachers had done even worse than college students in Minnesota or history enthusiasts in North Carolina. About 15% had voted for slavery, 2% to 5% for the election of Lincoln, 60% to 75% for states' rights, and 2% to 20% for tariffs and taxes. In short, just 17% to 20% got it right. Professional historians find it incredible that some sort of abstract commitment to states' rights is still widely believed to have motivated secession rather than preserving slavery and racial subordination, in the words of historian Christopher Olson, and they are right. Evidence to the contrary has always been available, in plain view. Yet, most teachers continue to present and misrepresent this issue to the next generation of Americans. Let me hasten to point out that none of these school systems was an educational backwater. Many of these teachers participated in special seminars under the National Teaching American History program. Nevertheless, most of them had been presenting an untrue version of why the South seceded, because they didn't know the key documents. The declarations supplied by the 11 Confederate states as they left the Union are among the more important documents in the history of our nation. South Carolina's is particularly central. They are all on the web and are hardly obscure, yet they remain little known. In The Confederate Reader, How the South Saw the War, which came out in 1957, has been repackaged by two other publishers since then and remains in print today, Richard Harwell included only the formal one-paragraph ordinance to dissolve the Union that the South Carolina Convention passed to notify the nation that the Union now subsisting between South Carolina and the other states is hereby dissolved. Harwell thus dodged entirely the crucial question of why. So did Rod Gragg, editor of Illustrated Confederate Reader, in 1991. Recently, the National Archives put 100 milestone documents on its website for Americans to ponder, but included nothing about secession. No high school history textbook quotes any statement about why the South seceded. Holt American Nation, for example, says, within days of the election, the South Carolina legislature called a convention and unanimously voted to leave the Union. Alabama, Florida, Georgia, Louisiana, Mississippi, and Texas soon passed similar acts of secession. Similar to what? Holt does not quote a single word from any of these documents. Not only do our textbooks avoid the documents, the accounts they do provide contradict the historical record. Holt, for example, writes, "The Southern secessionists justify their position with the doctrine of states' rights. They asserted that since individual states had come together to form the Union, a state had the right to withdraw from the Union." If read literally, in a certain minimalist sense, Holt is right. Secessionists seceded while asserting their right to secede. But that is hardly what people meant then by states' rights, nor is it how most people would read the passage today. Proponents of states' rights defend the power of individual states to make public policy vis-à-vis the power of the central government. The secession documents show that southern states were outraged by the rather feeble attempts by northern states to exercise states' rights, not by their own inability to do so. Other textbooks throw tariffs into the mix. The American Pageant, for instance, admits the low tariff of 1857, passed largely by southern votes, was not in itself menacing. Nevertheless, it goes on to hypothesize, but who could tell when the greedy Republicans would win control of Congress and drive through their own oppressive, protective tariff? This seems plausible, because after senators from the Deep South left the U.S. Senate early in 1861, that body, now dominated by Republicans, passed a higher tariff in March. But it had bipartisan support. President Buchanan of the pro-slavery wing of the Democratic Party signed it into law. Moreover, as the timing implies, opposition to this tariff hardly explains why seven states seceded before it passed and war broke out before it took effect. Not one state did anything substantive about tariffs when seceding in 1860 to 1861. Older textbooks were even less clear. Triumph of the American Nation was the best-selling textbook of the 1970s and 1980s, when most of today's teachers went to high school. Its 1990 edition offers only obfuscation. Why did the North and South go to war in 1961? What was the immediate cause of the tragic conflict? There is no easy way to answer these two questions. Historians have studied the issues for years and still reach different conclusions. Some historians have stressed the basic economic and social differences of the North and the South. Other historians have pointed to disagreements over tariffs, internal improvements at public expense, money and banking, the disposal of public lands, and slavery. Still other historians have emphasized the issue of states' rights. Thus, today's teachers are not exactly uneducated. Their problem is they have read their textbooks, but not the documents. Why do textbooks get secession wrong? Why would their authors not quote the critical documents easily available to them? Four basic reasons explain this failure. First, textbook authors have gotten into the habit of not quoting anything. One textbook even gives students two paragraphs about William Jennings Bryan's famous Cross of Gold speech, while not quoting a single word of it other than its title. Authors drone on in an omniscient monotone rather than letting the voice of the past speak. Second, publishers don't want to offend. Flatly saying that slavery was why Southern states seceded might cause state textbook adoption boards across the South to reject a textbook, or at least so worry publishers' marketing departments. As historian William C. Davis put it in 1996, all peoples part with their myths reluctantly, and historians are at some risk when they try to dismantle those of the Confederacy. At its best, history embodies the triumph of evidence over ideology. Textbooks do not embody history at its best. Third, authors are too busy to write their textbooks. Most K-12 textbooks, especially as they age, aren't really by the scholars whose names grace their covers. The American Journey, for example, lists James McPherson as one of its authors. McPherson wrote Battle Cry of Freedom, perhaps our best one-volume history of the Civil War. Two passages in Journey explain why the South seceded. According to the first, Lincoln and the Republicans had promised not to disturb slavery where it already existed. Nevertheless, many people in the South mistrusted the party, fearing that the Republican government would not protect Southern rights and liberties. On December 20, 1860, the South's long-standing threat to leave the Union became a reality when South Carolina held a special convention and voted to secede. Would not protect Southern rights and liberties. What might this mean? It is vague to the point of mystification. In Battle Cry of Freedom, McPherson asks precisely this question: what were these rights and liberties for which Confederates contended? And he answers immediately: the right to own slaves, the liberty to take this property into the territories. Readers of the American Journey get no such help. Journey then claims, Southerners justified secession with the theory of states' rights. The states, they argued, had voluntarily chosen to enter the Union. They defined the Constitution as a contract among the independent states. Now, because the national government had violated that contract, by refusing to enforce the Fugitive Slave Act and by denying the Southern states equal rights in the territories, the states were justified in leaving the Union. Again, in a literal and minimalist sense, the first half of that passage is right. South Carolina's declaration does point out that the original 13 states had voluntarily chose to enter the Union, and South Carolina did claim secession as a state's right. Otherwise, however, South Carolina made no state's rights claim of any kind in 1860. Indeed, South Carolina voiced no complaint with any policy of the federal government. Why would it? Lincoln had not even taken office, and Southern slave owners dominated the Buchanan administration. The South also enjoyed a majority of the Supreme Court. As McPherson himself writes in an article published the same year as his textbook, of all these interpretations, the states' rights argument is perhaps the weakest. The two reasons for secession that the last sentence of the textbook passage concocts, refusing to enforce the Fugitive Slave Act and denying the Southern states equal rights in the territories, are flatly wrong. South Carolina specifically noted that the national government had not refused to enforce the Fugitive Slave Act, nor had it denied to Southern states equal rights in the territories. Quite the opposite. The 1857 Dred Scott decision, supported by Buchanan, denied free states equal rights in the territories. It declared that territories had to be open to slavery regardless of their residents' desires. This paragraph in Journey is not what we would expect from America's premier Civil War historian. It is hard to believe that McPherson even read it, and impossible to believe that he wrote it. Fourth, downplaying slavery as the chief reason for secession got established in our culture as well as our textbooks during the nadir of race relations. We shall discuss that terrible period, from 1890 to 1940, when race relations deteriorated, later. Here, let us simply note, since the states' rights alternative became dominant around 1900, by now it has become a textbook tradition. It's hard for public.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?